gave us, which gave us at least one example of a case where there seems to be some kind of response to competition other than why would we care about competition, which is the case of the poor person chasing the cake. But we weren't sure whether which of the factors were really relevant to that, right? Is it poor? Does it matter they're poor? Does it matter it's a cake? The Gemara seems to use that as relevant. The Gemara uses it as relevant to a case about land, and in which both parties seem reasonably well educated. So it seems that it may have something to do with the phenomenon of competition, more than the specific economic circumstances of a poor person chasing a cake. Right then, we did a series of cases in Bava Basra, which seem to suggest that there is controversy about under what circumstances we regulate competition rather than allowing unfettered competition. There may be a Tannaitic controversy between Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and the Rabbanan, between Rabbi Yehuda and the Rabbanan, between competing Breitot, an Amoraic controversy between Rav Huna and Rav Huna Breid Rav Yehoshua. We have a series of stories at the end that may work only according to Rav Huna Breid Rav Yehoshua or according to both parties, and a series of arbitrary limitations, apparently developed limitations at the end of the sugya between when you sell, where you sell, whether you're fixed or not fixed, whether you pay taxes or not taxes, a whole set of additional qualifications on the phenomenon of regulating competition. When we got in, we also noted that the case in Kiddushin does not talk at all about prior restraint. It doesn't talk about preventing somebody from competing. It talks about how we think of somebody who went ahead and competed, although the response is Nikra Rasha, and then we saw all the literature about whether Nikra Rasha generates judicial redress, whether you can go to court to solve it or not. And as opposed to the case of Avastra, which seems to be talking about explicitly about prior restraint, that you can sue to prevent somebody from competing with you. We also saw, as we went through the Rishonim, we saw people introducing a whole new set of characteristics. The Rimigash in some way introduces the notion of the good of the consumer, which is not a factor that is explicitly mentioned in the Gemara, and that's modified in turn by the Nemukei Yosef and others. The Rav Yoh in the Mordechai seems to suggest the notion of ruinous competition, where if you set up shop in a way will deprive somebody else completely, if that's what the Rav Yoh means, like the three-sided mavoi. So we're seeing all sorts of new factors show up. We didn't really see people put those two sugyot in dialogue with each other. And what we're going to do today is, which we started yesterday, is we're going to do a...
Wait a second. Robert,
yeah.
You mentioned the Rav Yoh. We didn't see a Rav
Yoh. Avi Asaf is a Rav Yoh in the Mordechai.
Okay.
And Avi Asaf is the lost work of the Rav Yoh. I don't think you know. Maybe it's what we call the Sefer Rav Yoh. Is Avi Asaf? Not quite sure.
No. I thought it is.
Yeah?
He had two?
Because one was called, Avi Ezri and Avi Asaf or something.
Okay. So today we're going to finish doing a set of other cases, and then we're going to see that the Tosafot decide that all these cases have to fit together, which is not at all obvious since there's a machloket in the Gemara of Bava Basra. We could just assign these cases to different sides of the machloket. Right? And fitting them all together, it means you need to fit them together on the axis of what we think about them and how we think you ought to react to them. Right? Because you have at least three options. You have, this is bad, we should stop it. This is bad, but we're not going to do anything to stop it. This isn't bad. Right? We can complicate it further. We can say, this is bad, and if you did it, you have to give it back. This is bad, and we should stop it. This is bad, but we're not going to do anything about it. This isn't bad at all. And each of those positions can be further complicated. What we're going to see today, and once we have all the cases down, is we're going to move into the attempt of Tosfot to construct the theory of everything, but we don't necessarily have to buy that there needs to be a single theory of everything, because even the Gemara Bava Basra concedes that any theory of everything is going to have to choose sides. Let's put it in the economic framing. So the broad economic framing that we're using is you have, we set out three possible frameworks. The first one is that Chazal had no economic theory and neither did anybody else in halakhic tradition. And they just dealt with stuff case by case. And the only consistency they're interested in is legal consistency. They don't need any underlying economic theory consistency. As long as you can use the rules of law to generate a new result, it doesn't matter if we don't have an underlying economic theory of how things work. Yes, Tova?
Sorry, when you say economic theory, do you mean like a descriptive theory or prescriptive theory?
A descriptive theory of what happens, right?
Okay.
What happens if you do X? What happens economically? Y? What are the inputs? What's the relationship between, right?
Okay.
Between, right? All those sorts of things. So it could be that all this is just common sense people sitting down dealing with individual cases and individual circumstances, and because it's law, so law has to have some kind of coherence. So we construct some kind of rules about it, and we construct those rules. Our fundamental interest is enabling us to predict what the law should be in the next case, and not thinking about what kind of overall result we're going to produce. Law can happen that way.
That's like not how we do law.
It's not how we do law?
It's not how anyone does law. You don't just throw laws around. You don't need them to just be internally consistent. You have to take some sort of sense. Otherwise, we'd be going like, if you wear a hat, it has to be red.
So if it turned out to be very counterproductive, we might adopt it. We think, but common sense.
Yeah, but each assumption of common sense, there's some assumption there of like the way that people function, the way that people do business, the way that people ought to be, or morally, or ethically, or commercially.
So as a common, an ad hoc jurist, you can leave abstract consistency to philosophers, and say, you know what? In our experience, this has worked in that kind of case, and this has worked in that kind of case. And it's really interesting because these are two different things, and we don't really know why this. We don't have a deep theory about why this works in that kind of case, this works in that kind of case. But we know it does.
Okay, so you can assume there's a bunch of laws already. So we're just talking about like.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're just trying to put it together. Then there's a a second notion, which is that actually we do have an economic theory, and so when we make the law, we have overall goals that, right, and we have a sense of what means will achieve what kind of ends. Now there we have two broad possibilities. One possibility is that we fundamentally assume that the free market and open fair competition is always the best overall result for the most people. Right? So, and that's our, right, so when our goal is economic growth, that we're, right, our goal is always going to be to try and make sure the competition is free and fair. With the possibility that sometimes we may have values that override economic growth. Right? So regulation, right, will always only have one of two purposes, either the regulation is necessary to make competition free and fair, or else the regulation is necessary to achieve some kind of moral purpose which overrides economic growth. Right? That works on an economic theory presumption that free and fair competition always achieves the best utilitarian economic end.
So it's either to maintain the free market or to accomplish a moral goal
that overrides the free market.
Okay.
Second possibility is that no, we think that sometimes regulation is better economically. Right? We think that sometimes regulated monopolies are superior to free and fair competition. Right? So part of economic theory. So we can say that our economic theory generally is to maximize, right? Generally is to maximize economic growth, and we think that there are different means of doing that. Sometimes competition is best, sometimes competition isn't best. And we can also complicate what our moral goals are. So our moral goals can be defined in terms of virtues, which, right? So let's say this will achieve the most economic growth, but it's dishonest, so you shouldn't do it. Right, that's one, right? That's a virtue argument. And then there's a second argument, which is not a virtue argument, but a consequentialist argument, which is this will achieve the most economic growth, but it will also displace people. And we think that there is a moral issue in displacing people that justifies not maximizing the overall economic good of the population. Right, this, in a sense, is what is part of what we call the globalization argument in American politics now. Is it worth it if the GDP ends up larger, but all the auto workers, right? All the auto workers end up being fired. So those are economic background positions, which, depending on what you think the authors of a text saw, you will interpret it differently. If you start with the presumption that free and fair competition is always yields the best economic result, so then the only options you have in interpreting regulations are these must be necessary to ensure free and fair competition, or they have some kind of moral goal beyond that. If you think that regulation can be economically superior, and you can look at the same law or text and say, oh, they're trying to achieve this economically. Now, then we have our own challenge, which is it's very unlikely that every interpreter in the tradition shared any one of these positions. Right? Probably, I'm laying out all these positions, and probably different people in the tradition held each one of them in different ways. Now, we are trying to construct something that lets us go forward. But to do that, we're going to have to homogenize. Right? We're going to have to pray. We're going to have to do the same thing the Tosafists are doing with the cases in the Talmud. We're going to have to do with all the other data, right? Because we're going to try and synthesize things, and we have a factor that they had also, which is not only are we trying to figure out the things which make the most sense, but we're also trying to fit in with the things that have the most authority, because that's how halacha develops, not just by conceptual coherence, but by authority. Yes, Elliot.
That we have to homogenize everything and say, oh, we can say this is based on economic theory that we don't think works here, so we're not going to follow it. And if it's the Shulchan Aruch or Chaim, then that we might deal with it. But if it's the Rimegash,
okay, so you're already making choices, right? You say we have to deal with the Shulchan Aruch, we don't have to deal with the Rimegash.
Well, because that's dealing with the authority issue. Not that I feel a need to homogenize everything. I don't have to work with Tosafot's assumption that everything has to work, do I? As a halacha?
No, you can still make choices, but you're going to be much more inclined to accept the Shulchan Aruch, and even if it seems to you, right? So we go back to the shiur I gave Tuesday night, right? So here's the Shulchan Aruch, right? And here is the Ramban. So you're going to want to buy into both, especially the Shulchan Aruch claims that he's following him, even if you think that's not the most likely interpretation of the Ramban. So it's not that you have to absolutely homogenize, but there's going to be homogenizing tendencies that we should be aware of. And then hopefully you'll all find your own way through figuring out how you make choices. In that regard, what I always hope that you'll come to the realization is that there is no way to halakha can progress, which doesn't mean make progress. I mean, to go forward, right? You have to go forward in time unless you make choices like that. And everyone's making choices like that all the time. I'm just more transparent about the choices I'm making. Okay, so we were in the middle of the sugya in Bava Metzia, where the case that we were, right, where the Gemara began, we had a Mishnah, but we turned out that the Mishnah should not really be the beginning of the sugya. The Mishnah is just the heading, right? The Mishnah is the letter A of the encyclopedia. And the sugya really is apparently about Reish Lakish's statement, Arba Mot Shel Adam Konot Lo Bechol Makom. We are told the rationale for this law that Reish Lakish reports the name of Abba Kohen Bardla is that it was designed to prevent fighting. And then when we went through the Gemara's distinction between that and the Peah case, it was not at all clear to us how this legislation could be explained on the grounds of preventing fighting, because it seems very odd that in the end of the Gemara, the legislation says that things within four amot of you at least creates a sphere where other people, or an anti-competitive sphere, where nobody else is at
square, whatever.
Or square, yes. Where no one is allowed to compete with you for that object, but if you have fallen it, all of a sudden people can tackle you, and that doesn't lead to fighting. So we were puzzled about the Gemara's attempt at synthesis of putting Reish Lakish's law together with the Mishnah in Peah seems to yield a law that meets the description that Tova didn't like, of we just sort of cobbled together the cases and we don't really have in the end a theory about this at all.
Is there a case that takes us apart?
Is there a case that takes us apart? Well, let's try and find some case Is there a case that takes it apart? I have to find other cases that also are kal v'chomer that it would prevent fighting if you extend the legislation that way.
Well, the age was talking about this.
Yeah.
About if you, so I mean, that's what we were. This doesn't really work great with the Kohanim used to fight to do that.
Yes.
If they spread forma away from the mizbeah.
So that was right. That was a with Yesha, it really works to stop fighting. If you create the sphere, the problem again is why do we?
But it didn't work, which is why they
had to. Right, it didn't work there,
so they went on to the lottery. It didn't work at all. So that's an interesting critique, right? Maybe and what happens, right? We have an interesting legal question. What happens if it turns out that this doesn't work at all? Right? Do we still keep it as the law? If it turns out that people are beating each other up all over the time, and we've done economic studies that show that actually creating squares of anti-competitive space actually just leads to people buying bows and arrows so they can shoot each other from long distances, right? Or everyone goes out to the grocery store and buys their big grabber to extend your feet, right? So technology can change the equation, right? So right, what we haven't done so far, just to be clear, so far we're just reading texts. At some point, we're going to have to try and relate the text and the rules derived from them to contemporary reality, and that's a whole thing. Again, the simplest way of framing it is that no text that we discuss will have heard of corporations. All right, corporations are entirely different. Are entirely different beasts, and right, and our whole interest about them, maybe none of them apply. Right, so let's say this Gemara. Does this Gemara have any relevance to? Right to non-physical realities, frequencies on the spectrum. So we actually, the U.S. government to some degree, right, the capacity to broadcast radio at certain frequencies, the government basically ran something like this, right? Right, whoever gets there first, whoever gets there first wins, and then we can talk. Pardon?
How they sell the
frequencies? Now they sell them. As I was thinking about the Homestead Act, that's the post-Civil War period, right? The Homestead Act, right?
Yeah, but that was DACA for a purpose right. of, like, they wanted to incentivize people.
They wanted to incentivize people to go there, and how do you distribute the land so it doesn't lead to fighting, which hopefully they learned something from the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which, because there were other issues involved, like slavery, led to massive bloodletting as people tried to figure that out. Right, so the question, and that means a much broader question, which Professor Saiman will come in and talk about next week, which is I'm sort of making the presumption that this law is supposed to be useful in modernity, and that we're not just supposed to just say, well, we know that was then, this is now, and let's start over. So that's a question we're going to have to think about, because maybe corporations change the world so much that nothing we learn has any relevance to. To anything like that, because mostly it's not going to be individuals competing at all.
Right, but then it still has relevance in being irrelevant, right? That you have to like understand it thoroughly and explain it's irrelevant.
No, I can just say it's irrelevant. It doesn't deal with corporations.
But I don't think you can say that until you fully explored it, right?
Maybe.
Both defined
it's kind
corporations
of,
and defined it.
Yes, but I can just explore, all I have to do is make sure that corporations aren't people. And
it's not so easy.
Which that is a whole challenging question whether corporations are people or not, but an issue that is not really discussed in the text. As a whole separate, to my knowledge, Halacha has the Beit HaMikdash is a non-profit corporation. I think that is that's the model in Halacha that there are non-profit corporations. There are corporate entities like cities and things like that. But for-profit corporations, as something other than partnerships, right, as having genuine personality. I don't think there's a precedent for that.
Why would you divorce a for-profit corporation from just a partnership?
Because liability.
A partnership with a lot of people.
No, it's liability.
That's a legal thing.
Why? No, not technical. That's the whole point.
That's the whole point.
A partnership doesn't have personality because everything about it is divisible. But a corporation has personality because because its liabilities are not dividable among the owners. That's exactly the point. Are we going to corporations? That I shouldn't go too far into corporations. That was a tangent.
Are we going to talk about? I definitely missed a stuff which I just found about Mayan Benehayir.
So probably not. We're probably not going to deal with we're probably not going to deal with allocation of communal assets. As the right, that I think that's distinguishable. Okay. Yes, Avi.
If we were to say, if we come to a thing and we say corporations don't exist in halakha, we throw all the other things out the door. Do we just like, what is then like, what is our assumption? Do we assume things are like wrong and we need to control them, or do we assume anything is like?
All right, I'm gonna bracket that for now because that's Professor Simon's coming a week from tomorrow, and that's his and Rabbi Zuckier is coming in a week from today, and so both Rabbi Zuckier is giving a general shiur on the purpose of Dinei Mamonot, and Professor Simon will be talking about what is law, and to what extent is halakha law, and how does it relate to that. So all those issues will hopefully be addressed systematically in this context. Yes, Joshua.
I want to suggest corporations.
No, I don't want to talk about corporations. Really don't.
You just
I did, and I said I don't want to talk about bugs as a distraction. Okay. Hold it.
But you could have called on me before you said that.
Okay,
all right, Joshua, you have 30 seconds. Go.
Okay. If a lot of the way that halakha is supposed to work is a balance between strict legal obligations and ethical obligations,
yeah.
If we can't make ethical obligations on corporations, then our system will be out of balance.
Yes.
Because we'll only have the legal obligations, we won't be able to push back from the ethical side.
Yes, that's a big deal. Right? That's a big deal.
So that's the way that the things that don't apply to corporations would then affect everything else that would apply to corporations.
That's right. It's a mess. It's a mess. In my campaign finance article, I started to try to deal with this, what the limits of corporations are and whether we can impose ethical obligations on corporations. At the very beginning, it's not there yet. Okay, so we were yesterday. We were up to Rav Papa Amar. So now, Rav Papa Amar can be read in two ways. It can be read as an alternative to the Gemara's previous teretz to the stira between the halacha of Rav Yishlakish, and the Mishnah about Peah. We had a contradiction because the Mishnah in Peah seemed to say that Arba Mot are konot, that Arba Mot are not konot, but Yishlakish said Arba Mot are konot. And so our first resolution of that in the Stam is that we're talking about a case where the person fell and therefore demonstrated that he had no intent to use the Takanah Chachamim, and now we have a second possibility. The other possibility is that Rav Papa disagrees with Reish Lakish Mishum Abakoyim Bardla's report of the halacha, and he has different parameters for the Gzeira D'Rabbanan. For our purposes, probably we should assume the first, but I want to put the second out there. Second option is that Rav Papa is actually disagreeing with Reish Lakish. Right? He's not trying to reconcile Reish Lakish with the Mishnah. But right, Reish Lakish misreported. Reish Lakish said B'chol Makom, and I say no, not B'chol Makom. Okay. Yeah.
Take out the my timer. You could just say B'chol Makom taking Rabbanim. In any of it, like B'chol Makom is not the.
I don't know. Not sure that you can read it that way. Okay, there is, right, we are told by Rashi off the cuff that there was some kind of variant of Rav Papa's statement. Right? Zachi Garcina means that Rashi ends up, hopefully, with the text we have. Right? It's always a problem that the Diburi HaMashkil of Rashi get corrected to match the text of the printed Gemara. So even when Rashi says Zachi Garcina and we have our text, you can't know that's necessarily correct. All you know is that's the way our printed edition ended up, by matching Rashi and our Gemara. Right, the famous instance of where you could be careful about this, right, is the Rambam's Hilchot Sefer Torah and the Aleppo Codex, where people disbelieve the people in Aleppo's claim that the Aleppo Codex was the book of Tanakh that the Rambam wrote his Hilchot Sefer Torah from, because it didn't match. Mm-hmm. Until it turned out that actually the Rambam's Hilchos Sifrei Torah had been rewritten to match, to match the Sifrei Torah of later times, and actually were perfectly in accordance with the Aleppo Codex. So when you recreated the Rambam's original text, then it turned out that was correct. So our texts are constantly being edited to match each other, and you can't. So all we know is, if Rashi is Rafi Garcinan, there must have been an alternate version that had at least minimal plausibility. Okay, what does Rav Papa say? He says, "Ki takinu le rabbanan arba amos." When the rabbis created this rule that you have the square of non-competition, that was be'alma. So be'alma is a nice general word, which seems to suggest that it should be the default case, and then we should get to the exceptional cases. But one of the things you can look at is you can see that Rashi is not very happy just leaving Be'alma as Be'alma. Right? If Be'alma means everything, so you don't need any modifiers. But Rashi's modifier is a line and a half long. And Rashi gives you a whole list of cases. Right? The cases are a simta. What's a simta?
It's like a slip.
A what?
It's like in a river, like a slip that you pull into.
A slip.
I would say alleyway.
Alleyway? In a river?
No,
it's
like
a parking spot. Like Venice. A parking spot. Okay, it's some kind of, it's a public space which is not the Rishut HaRabim. Pardon?
Semi-public
space. It's a semi-public space.
I would say it's Dome Letzide Rishut HaRabim.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. So it's some kind of space which is not privately owned, but is not the most public of spaces.
Right. And there are some private rights there. That's the important part.
Like today.
Wait, sorry. So we're saying this is contradicting Rish Lakish by saying
Be'alma? I said two possibilities. Either it's modifying Rish Lakish by saying, well, he said Bechol Makom. Bechol Makom was perhaps really just means Be'alma. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that then Be'alma turns out to mean a whole set of specific. When you say Be'alma and opposed, so you're hoping that if you were doing your Venn diagram. Or your pie chart. You have a big pie chart, and so every case is going to be covered in this, is going to be part of this pie. And we're just saying, well, there's the most of the pie, and then there's a slice over here. But it's going to turn out that the way Rashi works it out, there's Be'alma, which is one slice of the pie, and then there's the other cases, which are the other slice of the pie. There's going to be a whole sets of things that don't fall into either, which is a very odd translation of Be'alma. If it really just means a different partial set, but the two sets together don't add up to the whole.
Okay.
So Be'alma, he thinks, means Kigon Besimta, which is Rishut L'Kol Adam, or Rishut HaRabim, or B'tzidei Rishut HaRabim, or on the sides of Rishut HaRabim, V'Hefker L'Rabim L'Mshoch L'Tocha HaTzrichin L'Seit Min Hadchak. Right? So this is a funny rabbinic category, are the places on the side. The places on the side of the road that still the borderlines, where it is private property, but it's private property which does not have a right to prevent trespass. Okay, in fact, it's even considered to be arrogant to not trample the grass on the side of the road. Although in Sharon, it's nice if you don't walk on the edges of people's lawns anyway, because we have nice wide paths. But Sidei Rishus HaRabim is basically the roads. If you look, let's say on the corner of Ames Street as you turn onto South Main, so where the commissars live now.
There's no sidewalk there,
and just about everybody crossing the street, instead of taking the really long passenger thing, they cut across the people's lawn to the corner, and so that part of the lawn is always trampled. It's always wonder whether when I avoid it, is it you or not.
Why would it be?
Because everyone does it, and so it looks like you're accusing all the other people of wanton trampling. It looks like you're holier than thou. Wanton trampling. It's a good word. It's a good phrase. Okay. So Rashi, interestingly, turns Be'alma into a list of three cases: Simta, Rishut HaRabim, and Sidei Rishut HaRabim. But however, he says, the alternative, he says, is Sadeh de Balabayit, lo takinu le Rabbanan. right? In this category called Aseret HaBalabayit, there the world, right? There this rule does not apply. Sharei ein la'adam shum arba amot miyuchadot, sharabei chavrim yesh lo betocha emdim eslo. Because Aseret HaBalabayit, Rashi tells you, is different. And he tells you why it's different. It's different because it's crowded, which is weird. Unlike Rosh Hashanah Rabim,
right,
which is not crowded.
Expensive.
Now, then there's the other problem. Right, there's the other problem. So, yeah, she'll take me through this, because I'm going to get totally lost.
It's okay. I didn't understand it.
So, tell it. Can you explain everyone why you didn't understand it?
So, I thought, in general, like, the reason you can be Kona in the Rosh Hashanah Rabim or whatever, or the Simta, because you have a right to be there.
Yeah.
As much or more than anyone else. And so your Arba Amos can be Kona for you. It's like you have either a Chatzar moving with you, or you have something going on that lets you be Kona.
Yeah.
But when you're in someone else's yard, I don't know. There are lots of people there, apparently, because they all equally don't have rishus to be that. You're lost.
Okay, so we have a whole bunch of problems, right? It's a private space which is crowded, more crowded than a public space. Right? That's really weird. Yes, Jen?
No, that's not weird.
Why?
Rosh Hashanah Rabim is huge.
Uh-huh.
Right? I'm walking. Like, yeah, there are lots of people, but I can safely... I mean, I don't think we're talking about New York. I think we're talking about a main big road in a less crowded place than New York, right? That's like, I can expect to at least have, like, some barrier around me. Whereas
uh-huh.
if I'm in the payout of someone's field, where that's, like, relatively small and there's tons of, like, poor people who are picking, like, there's no way to distinguish between my four emote and something.
Okay, so let's grant the reality, because I like the addition. Now you said, because we're in a private field and we're picking.
Right.
Okay, so now let's just try and, you know, get this lined up. A visual aids would be helpful. We'll try and get it lined up. Okay, so now we have two cases. All right, one case, right, we're trying to resolve, let's assume, right, the contradiction is in two cases.
Right.
There's the standard case where Arba Amot are Koneh,
mm-hmm.
and there's the case of the Mishnah and Peah where Arba Amot are not Koneh.
Right.
And there is the standard case, which is in a public space, and the private space where Arba Amot are not Koneh. So we're going to claim that the reason you're not Koneh in the Peah case is, the reason you're not Koneh in the Peah case is because it's too crowded. So we make this takana to stop fighting only when there's no one around to fight with you. But when it gets crowded, it doesn't work anymore.
Right, exactly.
Okay. And now let's just take us through the text, right? So we say, V'afal gav dezachal le'rachmana begava. So even though the Torah gave... So let's start with... Here, Yaakov, you can tell me through. We'll get Yishra's look. What did the Torah give whom? Ah, so it's not the Torah at all.
No, it is, because it's by Peah.
So, what do you think? What did the Torah give to whom?
The Torah gave poor people the right to go into someone's field to collect Peah.
Aha. Okay, so even though the Torah gave people the right to collect Peah, the Torah only gave you the right to walk in and collect Peah. The Torah did not tell you that it could be your chatzer.
Right.
It's still the private property of the Baal HaBayit.
Which is why I don't understand Rashi, because I thought it's clear that you get Kielu a chatzer around you for almost that makes a kinyan on anything around you.
So the fundamental problem is that we start off with the Rabbanan, and they can do whatever they want, right? The Rabbanan are right? No one thinks that your four amot work biblically. We think the rabbis created this takana to stop fighting. Yes, I know. To stop fighting. But the Rafapa's explanation in the end says, the reason the Peah case is different is because the Torah gave you the right for four amot, and the Torah never gave you that right in other people's property. Rashi messes every... But this is against the Gemara earlier, which says that the reason that you have this is a rabbinic decision to stop fighting. And Rashi messes everything up by introducing this notion of crowding. If it's a biblical law, who needs to talk about crowding? Yes, Shana?
Another issue also is that, like Rosh Hashanah Rabim is so general, but there are... I mean, you could argue, yes, that, like, you know, some roads that are Rosh Hashanah Rabim might not be crowded, but then what about the Shuk, which is also Rosh Hashanah Rabim?
Yeah, it's really, really weird.
I don't see your problem so with Rashi, it's still problematic. But the point is saying that you only have, meaning in the Shusaram, I have Rishos to be there and to move around and to pick things up and to have Kielu my Arba Amos be something that belongs to me.
Yeah, Deoraisa?
No, Deoraisa, I have the Rishos Shel Adam is for Amos. So I mean, Deoraisa doesn't make a Kenyan, but there are Deoraisa Dinim that are shy after the fact that my four Amos around me are mine. That they're Kielu my, we'll call it a Chatzar. They're Kielu my Chatzar that moves with me. So Chazal piggybacked on that and said, we'll make you a Kenyan for those things. We're only going to do Rosh Hashanah, and we're not going to do it in Rosh Hashanah, where the Torah never gave you such a concept
of
your own Chatzar with you.
So this is a slightly elaborate version where you're going to claim is that really it's sort of Deoraisa and sort of Derabanan, because
it's
a Derabanan notion built off a Deoraisa phenomenon.
Which is what all Derabanans are, usually.
Kein Deoraisa.
Yeah.
Okay, very nice.
And then Rashi just, I don't know where he came from.
Okay. Yes.
There's this Rabbanan principle. We have to figure out how you solve this theorem with the Deoraisa principle. And so Rashi is just coming to give us a good explanation, what he thinks is a reasonable explanation.
But what's the Deoraisa principle that we're resolving it? That we're trying to resolve? Why is the Derabanan in conflict with the Deoraisa? It's in conflict with a particular ruling about the Deoraisa. It's not in conflict with the Deoraisa per se.
Unless the Rabbanim assume that it is, right?
So you have to tell me on what basis they assume this halacha about falling on Peah is Deoraisa.
No. What? I don't understand. Nektalmik mitzat Peah is Rakhalashar in the Baklum. That's a rabbinic principle.
Right? So what's the biblical principle that's in conflict?
What they call Zechalei Rachamana.
We have to create this, but I'd say, but since previously we assumed the element was a rabbinic principle, that's Rish Lakish said, Takan Rabbanan, it's very hard to all of a sudden assert it's a biblical principle.
No, yeah, Rabbanan is a rabbinic principle. Peah is a deraita principle.
Right, so. But how you acquire Peah is not necessarily a deraita principle. There's no hint that deraita you acquire Peah by walking within four amot of it.
Oh, so Rashi's creating a machokas that he has to solve?
In a sense.
Unless he thinks it's bit,
I don't know. Elliot, what do you want to say?
I was trying to read this as only about Omer Shishra. At least the part from the Chaim Omer Shishra to Kizakaleh 28.
Okay. If it works out, great. Okay. Okay, so we move on to Amar Rava. Mostly from Idiq. So, Moshe Rabbeinu bar Yehuda Zikin, and he quotes the Mishnah of Ra'ah et HaMetziah v'nafal aleha, uva acher v'chazikba, zech shechazikba zechaba. So this right now, so we can't resolve it by any claims that Peah is different. This is right now we've moved it. This is exactly the case which you would think the Rabbanan would be mitake to prevent fighting. Two people see a lost object, and one of them falls on it. We don't want him to be tackled. Yes, Avi. As soon as we finish this. As soon as we finish this page. Okay, so he... Right, so this is exactly the case where the rabbis should make the takana, and yet there's no takana, so that seems pretty bad for Reish Lakish.
Wait, sorry, can you explain?
The case is, right, somebody sees a lost object and falls on it, and that's the point where we should blow the whistle. Right? If we want to stop fighting, right? You fell on it. That's pretty dark, right?
Right. And it's in your fault.
And instead we say, no! The second guy comes in and grabs it out of you, he gets it.
Right.
So this seems to be about as bad as anti-Rish Lakish's principle as we can imagine. So the Gemara first goes through mechanically the same approaches. So the first thing, right, the Gemara says, because he fell on it, but he didn't say mine. So the Gemara says, yeah, but the whole point is that he doesn't have to say mine because the rabbis made this Kenyan, and obviously by falling on it, he intends to acquire it. So the answer is no. By falling on it, he makes it clear he does not wish to use the rabbinic rule, which is a very weird claim. Because by falling on it, maybe he wishes to use the rabbinic rule and to ensure that he protects it against other people who don't accept the rabbinic rule. Right, and it's also circular.
It's to say that as he falls, it's a shout of acquiring this by the falling.
Yes, by acquiring this, but not by falling on it, right? It's a shout. I'm acquiring this just because I happen to be within four amot of it. And it's also circular, right? Because if we decided that falling on it was the rabbinic rule, Then he would be acquiring, right? Then he wouldn't be, right? Then he wouldn't be not showing he didn't want to use it by falling on it.
Does anyone have a clue what this means, falling on it?
Falling on it.
Do people used to fall on objects to claim them?
Like, why not? I say football.
No,
to, like,
you take it, you put it in your pocket, you stand on it, you sit on it, you don't fall on it.
It depends. If you're trying to protect it with your body from other people.
Are we talking about a case of, like,
you go running for it, then you die for it, and then you...
Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah.
Fall is just the broadest possible way of saying you take control of it, and it is the most obvious way of saying I take control of it.
I think by pay it's Dafka.
What?
By pay it's for sure Dafka.
Okay, but then here, I follow in CR, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's an extreme.
I think it's
it wouldn't be any different if you grabbed it.
No, like,
right?
No, that's why.
Is it something you can put in your pocket and walk away with? Is it the fall? You fall on it and then you get up and walk away? Is it that?
So you want to make it reasonable by saying
someone else is diving for it? Is it were you not in the Arba Amot but you ran into the
dog
to fall on it?
Those matter. I don't know. I say the case I keep thinking of is many years ago I went to visit a friend of mine in D.C. and we went out to a used bookstore. And in the first 5 minutes, each of us saw a copy of a book called The Pushcart War. I don't know if any of you have read it.
Oh.
Right?
Has it.
And we both... Pardon?
Prana has it.
That is a book.
We just read it.
It's awesome. And we both just dove for that book immediately. That's what I keep thinking of, right?
That's totally different, right? Because it's maybe... neither of you are in the Dalai Lama and you're running for it. And since, like, the question is, is this something that you're walking past and you'd fall on it, like, Pat?
I don't know anything about where the other. It says uvaacher. Another person came. I don't know where the other person came from.
Yeah, while you're falling on it, or after you've gotten up and walked away, you thought you made your claim and then you left, and he took it.
So you keep putting that. Maybe he got up and
I
walked
have
away.
No idea. Especially because we have this natal, right? I mean, pay of zarek al hashar is like I took something, I put it on the rest, and then assuming I'm not standing there, I probably walked away, and then nefal. Not sure what that case is, and then Paras Talito has also probably walked away, right? Yeah. We assume that that's what this means.
Walked
so
away?
Two cases of walking away, one case of not walking away.
Yeah, he put his talis on and then went to go get lunch.
I don't know. I mean, if you just threw pay on it and you walk away, how's anybody going to know that you threw pay on it? You have a big sign, I threw pay on this?
I don't know. So you're just standing there?
I think so.
So then why not just...
So what are the difference in these three cases?
Because you're trying to cover more space rapidly, I think. That's why you throw the peah. I think in the peah case are all ways of extending your physical reach.
Maybe it's in your basket that looks like your basket, and you put the basket that you have picked stuff on top of it, and so people know it's yours. You know?
Maybe. We can put facts in. I don't know. I don't see any facts. The facts are not in evidence that I know of.
Okay.
Gemara just tries to solve it the same way. He didn't say, I want to be Konez. So Gemara says, really? So what difference is? So Gemara gets into the same circularity.
Does it matter that the second time this phrase came out in the fall, like, Ale Dafat, it just, it's exactly the same if it doesn't say the word Ale, whatever.
The second time it doesn't.
Yeah, does that matter?
The first time says, doesn't say Ale, the second time doesn't say Ale.
It does.
Second time says Ale, yeah, I doubt it, I think it's probably just a typo, but it's a good observation. It's really weird.
Is it standard that we just repeat that argument verbatim?
It is. So again, you know, this is the general thing is that Gemara is memorized, so they like repeating the same.
Okay.
Right? It doesn't use up any extra disk space. Right? It uses up space on paper, but it doesn't use up disk space, and the Gemara is not supposed to be written. If you just have the symbol for ditto. Okay, Rav Sheshes comes along, and here Rav Sheshes introduces exactly the distinctions that Rashi, or the same terms that Rashi put into Rav Papa. Kita kina rabbanan, besimta, delo dacha ke rabim, right? It's in a simta which doesn't have so many people, it's not crowded. But in Rashus harabim, deka dacha ki rabbanan, lota kina rabbanan. So Rav Sheshes uses the same categories, but he doesn't use it to distinguish between a simta, Rashus harabim, and Siddur Rashus harabim on one hand, and a private field on the other. He just uses it to distinguish between Siddur Rashus harabim and Rishut HaRabim. And then the Gemara says, hang on a sec, it says Bechol Makom. How can you use Bechol Makom to mean only Simta? So the Gemara says, Kol Makom means Simta and Siddur Rishut HaRabim. But we're okay if Kol Makom excludes Rishut HaRabim. So we have the same structure as the second answer to both of these cases, but the division is different. The first case, according to Rashi, separates between the places where we do make this takana, which is Rishut HaRabim, Sidei Rishut HaRabim, and Simta, and the places where we don't, which is Stei Baal Bayit. And Rav Sheshes answering the second kasha, who says the places where we do make the takana is Simta and Sidei Rishut HaRabim, and the place where we don't, or Simta and Sidei Rishut HaRabim, and the place where we don't is Rishut HaRabim. Right? So they don't line up. And lichora, the rationales should be exactly the same. The only difference is that in one case, the only difference in the answers is that in the first case, we're trying to explain a case of peah. And the case of peah can only happen in a private field. So we have to say as well, private fields are different. And the second case is talking about a lost object, which is much more likely to happen in Rishut HaRabim than in a private field, because it's a private field that should belong to the owner. So we have two answers mechanically accomplish different things, but in the process of mechanically accomplishing different things, they make assertions about the rationale for the takana d'al adamot that contradict each other with no justification whatsoever. So we'll see that, or I don't know if we'll actually. You should know that there are, of course, different texts which try and adjust one or the other to. One answer or the other to match each other, or different interpretations that try and judge to match each other, or ways to try and figure out why it should make sense to make the rule of that alamot this way with regard to peah and that with regard to metziah. None of which are, in my humble opinion, remotely convincing. But they're what we have. Yes, Elliot.
But like, even the Gemara at all convincing.
Yes.
So like. It's as ridiculous to say Komakom is just two very distinct places as it is to say Belma means three distinct places.
Yeah, none of this is convincing at all. All right, we can go to eat lunch now. I have more than that.
I can say something crazy.
Go ahead, say something crazy.
It's good.